This is Lynn Cohen, April 8th, 2011. Seabiscuit, the little horse that could and did and still does. This was recorded on DVD, and the DVD is in the library. It does contain several short clips of the movie, Seabiscuit.
I'd like to welcome all of you to our meeting tonight. We're very, very happy to have Lynn Cohen as our speaker tonight. And if you have read in the newsletter, she's been a Jungian analyst for many years. She's been director of training for the Interregional Society, Analytical Psychology. And she's held a professorship for 10 years in the doctoral program in clinical psychology at the Minnesota School for Professional Psychology. She's also been honored as a distinguished scholar by Pacifica. She's had a series of lectures there. I'm familiar with Lynn because I've just finished reading her book, Tracking the White Rabbit, which I recommend. It's a series of essays. Part of it is, of course, she's talking about Alice in Wonderland. But she has several chapters and several topics, all of which are very, very well done. And as you can see why she is honored as a scholar. She talks about junk words. It's a very interesting article. And corn-fed music. Corn-fed music really is worth listening to sometimes. Talking about the psychology of abortion. The archetype of the victim, sexual encounters of the third kind, and the last chapter is called Blue Notes, and that was a lead-in, apparently, to her book, her other book called Portrait of the Blue Lady, which is a book on melancholy, and that actually, she talked in Portland a few years ago on melancholy, and that's actually, I think, when we first really noticed her and some of her work. So I'm very happy to have her tonight, and we will have our regular an hour or so lecture, and then we'll have a break, and then we'll come back for further work. Thank you.
Thank you, Bunny, not only for the intro, but for reading the books. That's always nice to hear. This turned out to be quite a remarkably eventful trip, none of which I really expected. But first, I want to thank you, even though I did it all on my own, I want to thank you for 2 days of sun. You have no idea what Minnesota has been like this year, the worst winter ever. It's just been quite remarkable, and I want to thank you all very, very much for the invitation to be here. And I love Seattle. It's an absolutely beautiful city. We had many adventures today and really good ice cream. I want to say just before we get started, a word about the workshop tomorrow. Which is going to cover a lot of the themes. We're going to go back and revisit some of the themes that I'm going to touch on tonight. They kind of pervade the whole lecture tonight, but tomorrow we really go in depth with them. It's about expanding and deepening the themes of tonight's presentation, particularly the ideas of vocation, fate and destiny, and the role of eros in the individuation process. We talk a lot, Jung had a lot to say about individuation, and we talk a lot about it, but what I'm really interested in is, so how do you do it? How do you do it for under $200,000 and 20 years of analysis? How do you do it? The other thing I thought that might interest you, it interests me, is that our subject tonight, the racehorse Seabiscuit, is buried at Ridgewood Ranch in Willits, California, Northern California, which is only 729 miles south of here. And I think that's close enough for his great spirit to be with us tonight, too. So I think of him as sort of being right next door, a little further south. Okay. Well, let me start with a word about how I came to this subject. I read Laura Hillenbrand's, I read her book, Seabiscuit, in 2001, which was when it first came out. And then some years later, I happened to reread Jung's essay, called The Development of Personality, which is also in, that's the name of volume 17 of the collected works, The Development of Personality. And I was struck, for the first time really, by Jung's reference to the development of personality as a heroic achievement. That's his word, a heroic achievement. Quote, an act of high courage flung in the face of life. End quote. An act of high courage flung in the face of life. Well, you know, like most people, I had not given much thought to how you actually acquired or became a personality. I mean, as an analyst, I was much more interested in what the personality was made of and what it was doing than in how it came to be. And many people, I think, assume that developing a personality just happens naturally, you know, as a matter of course, inevitably, unconsciously, as you grow up. But it doesn't just happen as a matter of course. And Jung goes on to say in that essay that we're each called to separate psychologically from the collective body and become a distinct individual, a unique personality. In short, we're each called to individuate. Some are even destined to become what Jung calls a redeemer personality. That's his phrase, a redeemer personality, one who brings about change in the collective consciousness. But to become a real personality, you know, an individual with a mind of your own and the conscious ability to be loyal to all of who you are, your vices, your virtues, your idiosyncrasies and all your oddities in between, this is no small achievement. It takes psychological courage. And it takes the inspiring and energetic power of the myth of the hero to pull us forward into that individual life we're called to live. Now, obviously, a personality does not develop only through a depth analysis, although one hopes. but it happens in many, many ways, and often is not recognized as an unfolding mythic process. So then, for me, the essay in Jung's volume and the story of Seabiscuit came together. I think one of the best examples of what Jung meant and how such an individuation process works can be seen in the true story of Seabiscuit and his human partners. So now I'm going to tell you about three people and a horse. Three very ordinary people, one apparently very ordinary horse. And it is because of their ordinariness that their story is so compelling, and 71 years later is still meaningful for us. Their story illustrates beautifully how myth informs and transforms our individual lives and gives us the courage necessary to follow the call that comes to each of us. Now, if you were born, or let's take a little audience survey. How many of you were born before May 17th, 1947? Come on, honesty won't hurt. Okay. Pretty good. Okay. Well, if you were born before May 17th, 1947, you are a contemporary of Seabiscuit, and so you are in this story too. If you were born after that date, you're still in this story because it's a mythic story, which means it's timeless, and its themes are reenacted in every era and almost always in every individual life. The mortal Seabiscuit died on May 17th, 1947. But because he has entered the realm of legend and even of myth, he's always contemporary and has become, like all true heroes, immortal. Now, one of the great things about movies, and I think one of the reasons we enjoy them so much, is that they're like watching a collective dream. You know, they reflect what's going on in the collective psyche at whatever point in time they're made. And like individual dreams, they often bring to consciousness what is needed to provide meaning, purpose, and movement into life. The real horse Seabiscuit and the marvelous humans who were his partners during the Great Depression became the dreamlike symbols of their era when, through the most unlikely conjunctions, they came together to enact a story of mythic proportions. And because myth comes from the deepest image-making level of the collective psyche, it profoundly influences the people in whose culture it manifests itself. Now, it's interesting to note that the book, Seabiscuit, published in 2001, was still on the New York Times bestseller list 2 years after the 9/11 attack. Now, since movies are so much like dreams, they always have more than one meaning and can be understood and interpreted from many points of view. And while a dream may be quite objective in its portrayal of a psychic situation, the interpretation of that dream is usually much more subjective. So there's something you should know about me right away, about my interpretive approach to the story. I'm a complete fanatic about horse racing, and I have absolutely no objectivity about the subject. So, full disclosure. Nor do I have any objectivity about Seabiscuit, because he is, to me, a true hero in the mythic sense. And you can never be objective about a mythic hero. It would, you know, be like trying to be rational and objective about your lover or about God. I think lovers and God deserve better than that. There's something you should know about Seabiscuit right away. He loved being exactly who and what he was. He loved being a horse. He loved being Seabiscuit. And as animals often do, and particularly animals who live in close relationship with humans, they teach us the essentials of living. You know, that there is no greater joy and no greater necessity than accepting fully who you are and living passionately in that fullness. There was something so intact about Seabiscuit, so alive at his core, that just being in his presence was restorative to people who had lost that sense of intactness and who had lost that passion for life. He was Seabiscuit, crooked legs, blocky body, gentle nature, but indomitable spirit, all this together, and he loved nothing better than to run free and faster than anybody. And when he was finally allowed to be all of himself as he was meant to be, he showed us the perfect image of the courageous heart that makes the hero, capital H. Now, I think one reason Seabiscuit's story is so appealing is because all horse stories, when they are well told, are appealing. Now, to mention just a few, and I know all of you have seen at least one or two or three of these. My Friend Flicka, you know, is a classic from 1943. The Black Stallion in 1979 was a beautiful movie. It was a huge box office success. The Horse Whisperer, made in 1998, very popular. And the story, of course, of Black Beauty, first as a novel published in 1878 and then as a British movie in 1994, has never lost its power. And you know that National Velvet, with a young 12-year-old Elizabeth Taylor, is still a very popular DVD rental. So we recognize in Seabiscuit a modern descendant of that animal honored, admired, loved, and just as often feared by every culture in every time and place where there have been horses. Few animals call out in us the variety of emotions and the depth and intensity of those emotions as the horse has done throughout history. The Celts worshipped the horse as the divine animal of the Great Mother. Warrior cultures in Asia, the Middle East, and Europe ennobled the horse as the spirit of valor and courage as partners in battle. The Prophet Muhammad was carried to heaven at night on a mare named Al-Burak, and for centuries, the mare who appears at night to take us away to an unknown realm has produced in us the terror we call the nightmare. The might of Alexander the Great's horse, Bucephalus, was legendary, and Robert E. Lee's horse, Traveler, was beloved by everyone for his stout heart and loyalty. The ancient Greeks elevated only one non-human to divine status to dwell amongst the Olympians, and that was Pegasus, the winged horse. So close to heaven does the strong, swift horse stand that the Bedouins say of him, "The breath of God blows between his ears." When horses arrived on the North American continent, indigenous peoples made them the preeminent animal on whom the sustaining of life and culture largely depended, and with whom a partnership was formed that honored the horse as companion, guardian, and warrior spirit. So horses built America, pulling plows across its fields, wagons across its mountains. I mean, how did you get to Seattle? carrying its mail, herding cattle, and giving us the uniquely American image of the cowboy and his horse, joined in a natural intimacy, a symbol of freedom and strength that dominated the American psyche for nearly 100 years. And the horse gave us the means by which we measure that which finally came to replace him, the amount of horsepower in our cars. The mythic horse is still powerfully at work in the psyche, keeping alive the qualities we have always associated with and sometimes projected onto it, and reappearing in the figure of a Seabiscuit to provide, once again, an image and a symbol of what we need. Now, in myth, the hero is usually an extraordinary human being who does battle with the gods, or is favored by the gods, or is half-god himself, like Prometheus or Heracles. Among thoroughbred horses, the heroic horse does the same as his human counterparts do, traces a proud lineage to the golden ancestors who came out of the Arabian desert hundreds of years ago, overcomes adversity, is strong and noble. And though the horse is an animal of prey, it has in large measure overcome its natural instinct to take flight from the sometimes predatory humans with whom it lives. To use Jung's phrase, the domesticated horse is a work against nature, an opus contra naturam. He has adapted to a world of complicated human-equine relationships from which he would normally be expected to flee for safety. When humans act heroically, they each in some sense transcend what seem to be their natural limitations, or they redefine those limitations. But what makes an act heroic is not merely the degree of strength or the measure of bravery or the willingness to endure hardship to accomplish something of great importance. Heroism is all these things, but it requires one thing more: the acceptance of responsibility for personal action. Without this acceptance, strength may be only brute strength, bravery may be blind, and endurance of hardship may be only stubbornness. It's in accepting responsibility for one's actions that the figure of the mythic hero can be perceived alive and working in an ordinary life. The real Seabiscuit was a physical, not a metaphysical horse, and yet he transcended physicality and the material world when he ran to his blood and lifted all those who saw him into some mythic world where giants with four legs really do walk the earth, where dragons named War Admiral really are defeated, and where usually gloomy fate not only takes uncharacteristic pity on the unfortunate, but actually smiles on them. Seabiscuit is a triumph of alchemy, the most improbable of ordinary ingredients, tested in the heat of crisis, transmuted into a champion. Now, for that, it took three particular humans who were willing to climb into the cauldron with him and be transformed themselves. Now, for those, how many of you have read the book, by the way, Laura Hillenbrand's book? Oh, I recommend it. I can't read, even before you read mine, well, after you read mine. Read Laura Hillenbrand Seabiscuit. It's one. It's really a sociological study of America in the Depression, but the story is meticulously researched, and the writing is so colorful and moving. It's just a sheer pleasure. How many of you saw the movie? Just about every. I knew Seattle was culturally literate. It's great to come here. Well, for those of you who haven't read the book or don't remember much of the movie, or in my case, aren't quite old enough to remember Seabiscuit's glory days from the 1930s. Let me just say a word of introduction about the three partners. Charles Howard, a 26-year-old bicycle repairman, went to California from New York in 1903 with 21 cents in his pocket. His repair business failed, so he tried selling automobiles. Turned out to be a much better idea. He became one of the wealthiest men in California and one of the most generous and expansive, gregarious, extroverted men who loved the spotlight and believed that there was no finish line except in the future, which glowed with fresh promise for everyone. But when his 15-year-old son was killed in a car accident, his grief was profound and permanent. His wife left him, and the future in which he had placed his hope and his son's life dissolved. The man who trained Seabiscuit, Tom Smith, was Howard's exact opposite in every respect. Born in 1879, living in the still Wild West, he was truly the last of the mythical American cowboys. There was nothing he didn't know about horses. He was psychologically part horse himself, I think. Writer Laura Hillenbrand describes Tom Smith this way, quote, "He had a colorless translucence about him that made him seem as if he were in the earliest stages of progressive invisibility," unquote. "He was withdrawn and solitary and had little interest in or use for human company. His future had been confiscated." The young man who became Seabiscuit's regular jockey, Johnny Pollard, called Red for the color of his hair, grew up in a well-off, happy, literate home. But even before the Great Depression, his father lost the business and the family became homeless and destitute. He was always a gifted rider. Johnny Pollard was able to earn a few dollars at small racetracks. When he was 15 years old, his parents, unable to care for him properly, entrusted him to an uncle who immediately abandoned him at a Detroit racetrack. Red Pollard rode when he could, was a small-time boxer when he had to be, became an angry, impoverished young man who nurtured his battered self as best he could by reading Shakespeare and poetry at night alone. He could not imagine a future. These are the human players in the drama. The fourth, which, as we know from Jung, is necessary for completion, was a horse named Seabiscuit, so named because his sire was hardtack. And if any of you know anything about Navy food, hardtack is a somewhat inedible, tasteless, dry, but life-sustaining food. His grandsire was the great man of war, who was also the sire of Seabiscuit's magnificent rival, War Admiral. But Seabiscuit had none of the handsome bearing of hardtack, and still less the majesty of man of war, and certainly none of either's awesome ability. Or, so it was thought, by those who bred him, sold him, owned him, trained him, before Tom Smith found him. As a 2-year-old, he had raced a brutal 35 times. As a 3-year-old, the only remarkable thing about him was that he was still able to walk. He was one of thousands of horses running at small tracks around the country in cheap races who lost more than they won. For him, there was no future. There are many reasons why author Laura Hillenbrand's exquisite book and director Gary Ross's marvelous movie have had such a powerful effect on readers and moviegoers. It's a masterful book of a completely true story, the details of which are lovingly and colorfully told, and it makes history itself witness to a timeless tale of defeat and courage and triumph. It's an unsentimental, beautifully made movie that illustrates the essential characters of the story in an all-too-brief amount of time, yet still caught the danger and visual excitement of racing as no other movie ever had. But I think the main reason for the success of both book and movie is this. It's a mythic story, and we are always hungry for myth. For myth is the psyche's mother tongue, the imaginal story language in which we recognize our essential selves and our potential for becoming. The story of Seabiscuit is a myth in the truest sense of that word, a story larger than life that teaches how to live life. And even though his story takes place 71 years ago, it is timeless in its emotional truth and therefore relevant in 2011. Our psychological landscape has changed since the era of the Great Depression and the decade following that saw the cataclysm of World War II. In America, certainly, we have since become a culture of psychotherapeutic interventions, which encourages self-exposure. You know, let it all hang out. How do you feel about that? Although neither those interventions nor the self-exposure necessarily lead to psychological reflection or maturity. It was possible in Seabiscuit's time for men like Charles Howard and Tom Smith to form close relationships built on mutual respect and trust without ever talking about their innermost feelings. And yet they follow those feelings, often without being able to articulate them, and perhaps not needing to. Gestures spoke and mattered. They were not empty gestures. Perhaps it was just this reticence, this sense of psychological privacy that worked to actually intensify one's emotional life. Since feelings could not be expressed much outwardly, they went inward and downward, compacted and concentrated. And I think we get the distinct impression from the characters in this movie, who were real characters and products of their time, that they were people who did not give much thought to who they were, or whether they were being authentic, or whether they were making the right choices. In this respect, they were much like the horses they loved, and Seabiscuit in particular. They knew who they were, without a great deal of existential angst, and acted accordingly. They may have lived in what we think was a simpler time, but they were not simple people. They may not have been psychologically sophisticated, but they were psychologically honest. No need for either pretension or denial of what was in them. This, too, is a form of heroism. Psychological heroism. Psychological heroism is the act of staring down life when it delivers its worst blows, of staring down the worst that is in you. It's not a moral code you must follow. It is recognizing the reality of things, of how life is and how you are, and meeting it head on. It's not brute strength or blind stubbornness. Psychological heroism is rather a marshaling of all the heart and courage and wisdom within you that gets you across the finish line. In a racing metaphor, the anthem of the psychological hero is this: the race belongs not to those who win, but to those who run. It's a good thing Seabiscuit's story is true, because it would fail as a work of fiction. His story has way too many improbabilities, too many synchronicities, too many second and third chances that just don't come around in life, too many recoveries from disaster, and too many victories pulled out of defeat. Only in myth can such things happen. Now, every once in a rare while in history, there's a conjunction of the impossible with the necessary, of the gloriously romantic with heartbreaking tragedy, and of the union of odd characters in a moment in time which alters the course of each character's life and stamps the moment in the collective psyche as a great image, a transcendent symbol, and a thing of beauty, which, as the poet told us, remains a joy forever. In the story of Seabiscuit, we have the classic structure of myth that can be told in the language of a fairy tale. It begins once upon a time, when everyone is hopeful and energetic and all things are possible in a bright, limitless future. But suddenly, like a terrible earthquake, tragedy on an enormous scale strikes. Soon the land is barren and grieving. Children are hungry, families displaced. Thousands of homeless people wander through an economic wasteland, foraging for food, work, shelter. Their hope is as threadbare as their clothes. Their future is gray as an unpromising twilight. It is the time of the Great Depression. The old king is ill, with an illness not of the body, but of the soul. And though he has raised himself from poverty and obscurity to reign over a great automobile empire, his beloved son is dead, and the future to which he had looked for inspiration and purpose is now gone. He is one of the fortunate few in the land who have earned a great deal of money and kept it. But all his money cannot fill the emptiness of his heart. With the loss of his child, he is no happier than his countrymen, for he too has lost his hope. His name was Charles Howard, and he was like a king in California. In this land, there is also a man who is of the earth, one whom the Indians of the West called the Lone Plainsman. He slept outside at night, owned almost nothing, wanted nothing except to be with horses, the most honest of animals, and so he saved his best self for them. He knew how to teach horses and how to learn from them, and he knew how to heal them when they were hurt. He knew these healing mysteries because he himself was wounded. He spoke hardly at all, and when he did speak, it was to whisper secret communings to the horses he loved. His name was as plain as the man himself, Tom Smith, and he was called Silent Tom when he was in the company of humans. But one day, an ugly scar appeared on the landscape that was his home, a fence with barbs in its wire. Now there was no longer free movement across the earth for either men or horses, and the land that once belonged to all the plains people and animals now belongs to only a few, displacing all others. Now the land is covered not with hoof prints and tracks made by horses, but with tracks made by tires and roads to carry cars, and they will have the right of way from now on. Silent Tom understands that he has lost his place, and with it the vision of the far-off horizon which meant freedom to live amongst the only truly free and generous spirits he ever knew, the horses. He, too, begins to lose hope, and with that loss becomes silent in more ways than one. Now, in every depression, collective or otherwise, at some point, a child appears. In this story, the child has red hair, sparkling intelligence, a love of Shakespeare and poetry, a remarkable gift for riding horses, the reckless bravery of youth, and the determination to survive against all odds. When we first see him, he's a happy boy, still with the full cheeks of childhood and clear eyes, reading poetry at the family dinner table. He does not know that the lines he quotes are his own destiny, and will also apply to the horse he will come to love, but who is not yet born. They are lines from an Emily Dickinson poem, quote, "We never know how high we are till we are called to rise. Then, if we are true to plan, our statures touch the skies," end quote. But before he's ready or willing, he becomes, for all practical purposes, an orphan, alone in the world at age 15, in that impossible period of life when one is too reluctant to leave childhood and too eager to enter manhood. He's uncertain of everything except his love of riding horses and what he has learned from Shakespeare. The world is a harsh, cold place. He is like a rough, stubborn, vulnerable young colt, weaned too early, too big to be a real jockey, too small to be a real boxer, too young to believe he can make it on his own, too old to believe anyone will help him. But because he is still only 15, there is much more life ahead of him than behind. And so he enters the story as the hope and the future. Unrecognized at first in his worn, fraying clothes, all his great potential and rage at life's cruelty masked behind a too-tough bravado. For a long time in this story, the raw talent and hope he embodies in his youth go unnoticed. And then there is a fourth figure, a smallish, badly shaped, utterly plain animal, whose very name emphasizes the plain and the ordinary, the dumbling, the outcast, who through 2 years of anonymity and frustration yet harbors a spirit that glows within him like a white-hot coal, waiting only for one little piece of kindling to make it burst into flame. Like the philosopher's stone that is rejected by everyone because no one realizes its true value, this horse with crooked knees looked out at the world through an eye so bright, so determined, so full of power, that had anyone taken time to drop their assumptions and look deeply into him, they would have seen in that eye the look of eagles. And in the way of fairy tales and myths, it's by chance, random luck, intuitive decisions, and unbelievable turns of fate that these four lonely wounded figures find each other. You could say in Jungian fashion that the unconscious psyche has brought into the world a true mythic quaternio and has brought broken, scattered pieces together and made them whole. But at this point, the fairy tale ends, and not yet happily. The coming together of these four is not the end, but the beginning. And once they have come together, they leave the fairy tale and enter real life. At this point, as the movie makes clear, and as the book made even clearer, Real life is now played out not as fairy tale with impersonal, faceless characters and pure archetypal roles, but as mythic enactment and with intense human emotion. The mythic theme of the story is the cyclical nature of heroic struggle. For every victory, there's a defeat following, and for every defeat overcome, another victory. For every triumph and gain, there's tragedy and loss. They follow inevitably as night follows day. In this tale, it is not victory that defines the hero, but perseverance in its pursuit, and how one meets tragedy, loss, and defeat. The hero in this story, and there are really four of them, is made, not born. Just as Seabiscuit must find it in himself to reach the greatness that will lift him to heights transcending the ordinary, so his human comrades each must find in themselves the courage to come to terms with their own tragedies, losses, and defeats. As in all tales of heroes, it's a story of redemption. And beyond that, it's a story of how the collective soul of an entire nation is at least partly redeemed and restored to hope when even just a few take conscious responsibility for fully becoming who they were intended to be. We see how redemption is possible when even only three individuals willingly follow the irresistible pull of those deep archetypal forces now appearing amongst them in animal form. The story of Seabiscuit shows us a fairy tale deepening into myth, the story of a few people whose care for each other brings about a change in the collective psyche and an exquisite image of how the lowly animal once considered of no value turns out to be an incarnation of the immortal Pegasus, wings and all, like a god amongst us. Director Gary Ross undertook a difficult effort, I think, in adapting Laurie Hillenbrand's book for the screen. I think the reason the movie succeeded so well was because Ross made the right decisions to emphasize those aspects of the story that could best be dramatized and draw the audience right into the story, right into the time and place in which it happened, even though we're 71 years removed from it. He chose to emphasize the relationship among the three men and the three men to the horse. So each figure becomes a catalyst for the other, but it is Seabiscuit who makes these relationships possible in the first place. He is, in Jungian terms, a figure of the self, the psychic factor that brings everything into relationship with itself. The movie shows us the importance of allowing ourselves to be led by movements in the psyche we do not understand. The story unfolds as a series of what we might call subliminal recognitions, as each of the characters respond instinctively to what they perceive in the other without really knowing just what it is they're recognizing. Now, at their first meeting, Seabiscuit's eventual owner, Charles Howard, sees something in potential trainer Tom Smith that draws him to the man. Perhaps it's their mutual sense of loss, Howard for his son, Smith for his place in the world. Now, here's the scene in which the very first fateful meeting takes place.
Thank you.
Now, Smith seems to see in Howard a rare acceptance and the same generosity of spirit he so appreciates in horses. They don't waste words and they don't speak many of them, but in that meeting, they each take the measure of the other and find something they have each unconsciously been looking for. In Tom Smith, Howard finds an elemental wisdom from an earlier uncomplicated time before there were fast death-dealing cars. And Smith finds in Howard a deep and genuine respect for his own kind of plain-spoken honesty that the rest of the more cynical world disdains. In young Red Pollard's wounded but untamed spirit, trainer Tom Smith perceives an affinity between rider and horse, recognizing in that affinity that here is the rider he has been searching for to partner with his very difficult horse. Pollard is drawn to something strong and certain in Smith, just as he's drawn to Seabiscuit's weariness, bad treatment, and frustration. Owner Howard is drawn to Pollard because he sees in him the spirited son he has lost. And he sees also his own struggle with despair. Pollard is drawn to Howard because he sees in him the longed-for father of his childhood. And then there is Seabiscuit, who appears literally out of the blue, the dark blue pre-dawn obscurity on an ordinary morning at what could be any ordinary racetrack anywhere. As he enters the world of these three humans, Seabiscuit sees into each of them and is finally seen by each of them. It's Seabiscuit whose keen eye meets Smith's in a chance meeting before sunrise, which happens to be the traditional time when mythic heroes are born, and in that brief moment communicates to Smith everything within him that makes him unique among racehorses. And Smith, who speaks the language of horses, understands everything that Seabiscuit says to him. Everything up to this moment is introduction. With this meeting, the story really begins. We are not only identified with Howard, Smith, and Pollard, and even Seabiscuit. We're also identified with every person in America who had endured a year of on-again, off-again negotiations between Howard and War Admiral's owner, Sam Riddle, to make the race happen. It's important to note that War Admiral was himself an athlete of heroic stature, a Triple Crown champion with a fiery temperament and unquestioned bravery in competition. He was the most worthy rival, which made the ranch race all the more thrilling. The time sequence actually was abbreviated in the movie. It seems like it's a little bit shorter than it actually was. It really did take a whole year of on-again, off-again cancellations, new agreements, and everything to bring the race off. And you have to remember that at this time, horse racing was America's number one spectator sport. Everybody listened to the races on Saturday. Everybody scraped together a couple of bucks to go to the track and spend the day there and, you know, try to make a few bucks on a winner. Watching the film, it seems almost like a whole year before the race begins. Now, I want you to watch how, not just the scene, but how the climactic race is set up in the movie. That is how Seabiscuit made a rear admiral out of war admiral. It's a wonderful piece of choreography to get two horses to run exactly step by step the way the original race was run. It's a marvelous, marvelous thing. It's an inspired piece of filmmaking because Gary Ross breaks with the conventional approach to a climactic scene in order to elevate the personal present into the collectively historic. He takes his time and cuts away at the critical moment. You know, there's no Hollywood grand rush to the big moment, no dramatic photography to show us the break from the wire. Instead, we are at one with the 40 million or so people, one-third the entire population of America, who heard the great match race on their radios in 1938, including Franklin D. Roosevelt, who delayed a press conference so he could listen, too, although he never said who he rooted for, but he's a politician, you know. We're all one, waiting and waiting and waiting one more minute after one more minute after one whole year. And we feel the same anxious tension, experience the same unbearable excitement as the horses approach the wire. And then time falls away, and there's only the imagination, fed by the announcer's description of what is happening at what is now the center of the world, Pimlico Racetrack, where we are all, you and me and all of them, gathered. And just when you would expect the movie camera to stay focused on the two horses and the dramatic, long-awaited start of this race, the screen goes white. And we're taken to black and white still photographs. The only moving thing now, the voice of the track announcer calling the race louder and louder. And then suddenly we're catapulted right there into that moment and the horses come at us head on. If you never saw a horse race in your whole life, this is the one you don't want to miss. You can hear the race call on computer, by the way, the original race call. We listened to it the other night. It's amazing. I'll give you the website afterward. The second climax of the film comes with the running of the Santa Anita Handicap of 1940, which was actually Seabiscuit's third attempt at it. Charles Howard was instrumental in getting this race. The richest race in America was called the 100 Grander, $100,000 purse. And it was first run in 1937. Seabiscuit lost by a nose. In the second running, which they didn't show in the movie because of time constraints, he lost by a split whisker. And now comes his third attempt at it. And as we approach this race, the whole movie, the whole grand story, can now be seen as the triumphant conclusion in which we have indeed seen the redemption of Charles Howard, Red Pollard, and all those millions of people whose hope in Seabiscuit restored their own that had been lost. Howard is able to release the painful loss of his son to the past and allow Red Pollard, who has become like a son to him, to risk life again. The young orphan Johnny Pollard has grown into a man of indomitable will and has discovered his capacity to feel and trust again. Even Tom Smith has come out of himself to an extent and entered the community of human beings, although since he is an anachronism, he will never be truly one of them, because what he has lost, his place in that world, his whole way of life on the open range, can never be restored to him. His redemption comes in the form of the horse, Seabiscuit, who, though he cannot replace the way of life Tom Smith has lost, gives him the closest thing we have to immortality. For as long as we remember Tom Smith, as long as we remembered Seabiscuit, we remember Tom Smith. Now, in the final scene of the movie, we are brought back almost to the beginning of the fairy tale, as if nothing has yet happened, and so everything is still possible. And once more, the foursome will try to win the coveted Santa Anita Handicap, the great 100 grander. Johnny Pollard, already blind in his right eye, is riding with his fragile right leg, you saw him in the hospital, re-injured it, in a brace. Seabiscuit has recovered from a most serious injury and returns to compete against younger, sounder horses. as we see Seabiscuit coming into the final yards of the race, everything slows down, giving us a chance to feel the deep satisfaction of a great challenge well met. We're given time for reflection and remembrance, and to begin to grasp the magnitude of the achievement of our four heroes. And we witness the culminating redemption of the horse and his companions. It's visible in all their faces. Seabiscuit leading the way. The camera pans away to the crowds in the stands. Well, we can see ourselves there too. We're there too. And it pauses briefly with a last look at Smith and Howard and the indescribable joy on Red Pollard's face. And then the empty track stretching out ahead. It's a scene of transcendence, and we know now that the story is complete. Not over, but complete. The whole story recedes like the racetrack behind them into the past, to live permanently now in human memory. In this last scene, we again join all those who saw in person Seabiscuit's final race at Santa Anita and all those who listened that day on their radios across the country. And we see from Seabiscuit's and Red Pollard's perspective that wide open expanse of racetrack, no horse or any obstacle in sight, nothing at all between us and the finish line, which, as Charles Howard had been telling us for years, is the future, and which we all know is where there is always hope. But, true to the mythic timelessness of the story, we do not see Seabiscuit reach the culminating moment of his entire life. We do not see him cross the finish line. That would bring an end to hope and betray the myth. The mythic tale of the real-life hero can never end because it's about the cyclical nature of struggle and victory. The cycle of victory continued for Tom Smith and Red Pollard, and even for Charles Howard, whose health began to fail only a few years later. We know in our own lives that no victory is ever permanent, nor a guarantor of eternal bliss. Only Seabiscuit, the little horse that could and did, lives happily ever after. And like all mythic heroes, Seabiscuit really does live forever. And that's why we're able to talk about him tonight in the present tense, in the present moment. And it may not seem like any great thing that because three guys loved a horse, they became heroes. Still less to regard a funny-looking horse with crooked legs as a hero, too. But each of them, in their own stumbling ways, step into the larger-than-life shoes that the mythic hero wears. They show strength when painfully difficult decisions must be made. They act with raw courage when natural fear threatens to paralyze them. They endure when there seems no point in enduring. And they each accept responsibility for their own decisions and actions. They do not do this consistently. They are mortal and very flawed. But when the moment demands it, they rise to the occasion, which is what heroes do. Neither displacement, broken hearts, serious injuries, loss of parents, nor even the death of a child stops these individuals from living their lives as deeply and passionately as they are able. In an essay on heroism, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "Heroism feels and never reasons, and therefore is always right." Now, while some of us, especially those of us like me who are thinking types, may shudder at this, there's a certain truth in it. One's instinctive feeling, animal-like, non-rational impulse may be as sure a guide to right action as prolonged reflective thought, and perhaps in many instances more so. The three humans in Seabiscuit's story are each guided by just that feeling sense that is not constricted by reason nor delayed by second thoughts. They respond to each other instinctively with trust and let affection come in its own time. And when each must make a fatal decision, the other's lives are affected by it, and so each must bear responsibility for that decision. This is most clearly portrayed in the film when Charles Howard must decide whether to allow Red Pollard to ride Seabiscuit in his last race, Santa Anita Handicap. It's the race Howard wanted to win more than anything, and to let Pollard ride meant risking the lives of this young man who had become like a son and the horse he loved beyond words. Pollard must decide whether to risk his career, his future, his very life, to ride the Biscuit in the most glorious race, the crowning race of both their lifetimes. And Tom Smith, Silent Tom, knows deep in his bones that he will never find another horse like Seabiscuit and will never feel the same way about any other horse as long as he lives. And now he must decide whether to risk this horse's life in one more last race. For all three of them, the decision to be made is fateful, involving life and death, and there's no changing of mind once the starting gate opens. The decision each of them makes, and the way they make it, is heroic, showing strength, bravery, endurance, and ultimately personal responsibility. They each understand also that in some sense they are making the decision for history. For such an amazing horse, in such a splendid race, with such a courageous rider, will never take place on the American turf again. And so it is a decision for the ages, for us, here and now, tonight, as well as for the millions who will listen on their radios again, as they did 2 years before, and whose collective energy and participation in the myth unfolding at Santa Anita will carry that horse over the finish line in first place once and for all. In the final analysis, it's Seabiscuit who emerges as the ultimate hero, the embodiment of strength, courage, endurance, and all the additional qualities humans have admired and loved in all heroes, human or equine. Nobility, grace, the effortless acceptance of who one really is, and the passionate embrace of whatever life brings. It was Seabiscuit who called out the heroism in his human partners, brought them into relationship with each other, and demonstrated through his own nature how they could each fully affirm theirs. And though Seabiscuit, even with his great intelligence, did not understand the word responsibility, he showed us how to accept it, to be loyal to who you really are, to accept the consequences when you refuse to run to another's wish, when to stand firm when you run to win, even though others want you to lose, and when you decide against all collective morality that the most important thing in the world is to take off the saddle once in a while and lie down in the grass for a nice long nap. There's good reason why it is that a life-size plain statue of Seabiscuit, from among all others, stands in the place of honor at the front entrance of America's National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame in historic Saratoga Springs, New York. I want to give you a quote from Heywood Hale Bruhn, an eloquent and wise man. He was one of the most literate American journalists of the 20th century and a lover of horses and racing. And in his late 70s, he was interviewed as part of a television biography of honoring the Champion Racehorse Secretariat, and asked to comment on Secretariat's performance in the 1973 Belmont Stakes, in which Secretariat not only became the first American Triple Crown winner in a quarter of a century, but did so by an astonishing 31 lengths without exerting himself and in world record time, which has never been threatened and is likely to be unlikely to be equaled. It's a feat unparalleled in racing history. And when he was asked how such an accomplishment can be explained, Bruhn shook his head in wonder and said almost wistfully, quote, "Every now and then, some athlete is touched for a moment with a kind of higher level of greatness that they may never achieve again. But in that moment, they were more than life allows." The heroic moment is that in which we become more than life allows. And the moment does not last forever. It adds a heavy note of tragedy that is also part of the hero myth to consider that within just 7 years of the great Santa Anita Handicap of 1940, Seabiscuit and Charles Howard were dead too young. Tom Smith had unjustly lost his place in the racing world. Ed Red Pollard had fallen back into obscurity. We cannot live in heroic mode all the time. The myth does not require it, and life does not allow it. But it's the particular moment, the singular occasion, the specific context of need that calls forth the hero in us, just as Seabiscuit's historical moment called forth the heroism of his three human partners and effected change beyond their imagining. For us, the moment may arise as a difficult moral decision, or as a test of our capacity to love, or our ability to relinquish something of great value. You know, should I dare to blow the whistle when I see wrong being done? There's a consequence to that. Can I love the one who has deeply, deeply wounded me? Am I able to stand for a principle, even though it might jeopardize my career? When the heroic moment arrives for each of us, we step into the myth of the hero, and it becomes our myth, and for that moment, we become more than life allows. And when the moment passes, we return to ordinary human-scale life. But that life has been changed forever. And though the effect may not be known even to the one who has acted heroically, it has wrought a change in the collective psyche and has become part of human history. So now let's leave the story of Seabiscuit with one last glance back to his era, which, as we know, was an era not only of national but worldwide depression and hardship. And as his story is an archetypal one, it's both amazing and yet not surprising that the same mythic theme was being enacted on two other continents at the same time. In England, in 1930, a colt with a noble pedigree was born, but who was so small he couldn't reach the feed trough. He was sickly, and his owner was so disappointed. He couldn't decide whether to sell him or kill him or just castrate him and make him a pet. But because the horse was of no consequence, the owner lost interest, forgot about him, and ended up doing nothing. The best decision never made. When he came of racing age, the farm's trainer offhandedly thought he'd at least try him in a low-level competition, said he might win some pony races. And that was the beginning of the career of England's greatest champion, who won nearly every major race in the United Kingdom, and when he retired in 1940, went on to become one of the world's great sires, and whose name appears in the pedigree of approximately 85% of today's thoroughbreds around the world. In 3 weeks, when the Kentucky Derby is run, every single one of those entries will have this horse in their pedigree. His name was Hyperion. But the English, who loved him, always called him the Little Hero. And his bronze likeness stands sentinel in front of Great Britain's National Racing Museum in Newmarket, where the thoroughbred breed began, and racing began 350 years ago. In Australia, in 1927, an oversized, thick-headed yearling horse was purchased for $180 American by an owner through the agency of an obscure, down-on-his-luck, hard-luck trainer. The owner took one look at him and wanted nothing to do with him, saying he looked like a giant mule. He was too big, he was gangly and awkward, and promised to be unnaturally slow. But the trainer persuaded the owner to give the horse a chance, and the horse, whose name was Farlap, meaning lightning strike in Sanskrit, became Australia's greatest champion, whose unfailing courage and heart lifted the entire country through the dark days of the Great Depression. He overcame so much adversity that his name became synonymous with hero. And when he died prematurely, the Prime Minister declared a national 30-day period of mourning. Flags were lowered to half-staff. His body was preserved by the world's greatest taxidermists, and he now stands, as he has for more than 70 years, in a place of honor in Australia's National Museum Victoria in Melbourne. And many would say that he was the world's greatest racehorse of all time. And then there was America's hero, the indomitable Seabiscuit. The myth of the hero is timeless and universal, which means there will always be heroes appearing in the collective body when the times demand it. In our time, there are plenty of hardships and difficulties facing us, personal losses, job losses, financial losses and a painful recession, losses from natural disasters, and a very uncertain future. And we have human heroes, individuals who are usually unaware of how the myth of the hero has carried them to meet the necessity of the moment. And we, often equally unaware, benefit from their heroism. Each of us has been, is now, or will be called to psychological heroism more than once in our lives. Each of us will be granted at least one moment when we become more than life allows. And at various times of need in our collective life, it may well be Pegasus, the winged horse god, who will reincarnate once again to remind us that there is still honesty, hope, and beauty in the world. Thank you.
Thank you. And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.